it has changed the way that we can imagine the building, for example, of the Big Pyramid of Giza, because we are seeing the other side of the monument in a way. Of course, it's quite evident to see the pyramid itself, but when you have a glance to the people that were building it, and when you begin to understand the kind of logistical organization you need to have this monument be built, it's really interesting.
Hello and welcome to the Dive and Dig podcast, where we take you on an underwater journey across the ancient world from the Stone Age to the late Roman period. My name's Lucy Blue.
And I'm Bethany Hughes. And basically, Lucy and I just sit and chat about underwater loveliness for a few minutes. And this one, I mean, it is so extraordinary because now we're going to take you right the way back to the start of written history itself, to something which is, I mean, it's a truly incredible find. It really annoys me, Lucy, when people use superlatives the whole time. But this really has got some things that are the biggest, yeah. Some that are the oldest, some that are the first. And we're kind of inviting you to come with us to the land of the pharaohs, to Egypt, to remarkable finds on the shores of the Red Sea, which is, Lucy, it's somewhere, I know that that's a coastline that you know pretty well, don't you?
Yeah, I've spent many, many years working on the Red Sea coast, and I have to admit that this find is quite remarkable, and I wish I'd found it, actually, because as somebody who's a lover of harbours, this is the most remarkable harbour. I mean, it stretches way back much earlier than anything that anybody ever found, you know, in the sea, in effect, previously. And we've got this huge, huge site. I mean, it stretches over, I don't know, something like 6 kilometres from the coastal mountains down to the shore, and then on the shore and going into the water, they found this incredible, huge, L-shaped jetty that was used, you know, to shelter boats over 4,500 years ago, which is just a total first.
Because I'm doing a lot of work on the 7 wonders of the ancient world at the moment. Of course, the Great Pyramid of Giza is one of those, and this has a very particular connection to that extraordinary site. So I met the director of excavations, and I think you can hear from the tone of my voice how thrilled, I mean, sort of ridiculously, childishly thrilled I was to get the chance to chat to him.
Now, I can hardly contain my excitement because I'm just about to meet somebody that I must confess is genuinely a hero of mine in the archaeological world, Pierre Tallet, who's the chair of Egyptology at the Sorbonne. Excited to meet him, but also because of the site that he's currently been working on. It's Wadi El Jaf in Egypt. It's on the Red Sea coast. Extraordinary things are coming out of this site. And I've actually never had the chance to speak to Pierre myself. So as I said, I'm like a child, Pierre. I'm so, so thrilled to be talking to you. But the important thing is this site, which I know is unique. It takes us right back to the 4th dynasty of Egypt. So around the time of the pharaoh Khufu, who people might know as the man who we famously think was responsible for the Great Pyramid. So just explain why it's such a particularly extraordinary site. I mean, apart from anything else, we're talking about a site that is partly submerged, that is partly underwater, but there are also finds on land too.
Of course. Well, we are excavating since 2011 this place of Wadi El Jaf, which has been used as an harbour by the Egyptian at the time of the 4th dynasty. It was probably created during the reign of the founder of the 4th dynasty, the king Snefru, the father of Khufu. I think the main purpose of this harbour was to go to South Sinai, where the most important mines for copper were worked by the Egyptian at that time. And I was also working in Sinai for a long time, and we found furnaces and mines from which the copper was probably extracted as early as the very beginning of the Old Kingdom, the 4th dynasty. By making this harbour at this place, they were able to establish a permanent connection between the desert of Egypt and the Nile Valley and the miners that were working several months in the mines. So it's for the purpose of bringing the food and taking back the copper, that's the harbour is mostly interesting for them. So it's on the Red Sea shore, and we have several settlements. Of course, we have an harbour with a big jetty inside in the sea itself. But we also have camps that were used by the workers that were sent to the place to dwell. And we have a huge system of magazines that were used to keep the material of the expedition in between two expeditions on the Red Sea shore.
Magazines that he's talking about. So those are basically storage rooms, aren't they, Lucy?
Yeah, no, absolutely. They're really quite amazing because they're, as I said, the site is huge, and the mountains come down to the coast, and they've literally dug into the mountains to create these caves where they stored things. Really, really well preserved. It's really incredible. But yes, this the French term magazine.
I just suddenly, literally, as you're saying that, is that why we call magazines magazines? Because there's lots of different bits and pieces stored in them. Could be.
Well, I don't know. I had to look into that one.
Google the old etymology. Yeah. But that's right. So it's a site that, so you've got these storage rooms, which, of course, again, as an archaeologist or a historian, oh my gosh, we love a storage room because there's things are stored in them. There's going to be lots of evidence. So it's on the shore and underwater as well. But, I mean, the level of preservation is incredible. And the variety of things that they've discovered in these storerooms is just staggering.
I know. And I think this, I mean, having worked there, as we said, is what you find is generally, as underwater archaeologists, you'll find good organic preservation when it's buried under sediments. But here on the Red Sea coast, because the conditions are so dry, you actually find organics, so timber, materials preserved effectively in the open air, which is, you know, almost unique, actually. So, it's a pretty amazing site, and I just, one day I'll get to visit.
Yeah, one day you will. I mean, you've got the level of preservation is so incredible. Some of the stuff, when it comes out of the sands, it just looks like it was made yesterday. I mean, obviously, that whole tradition of mummification started originally because you would get these natural mummies, you know, bodies that were just buried in the sand and then became desiccated. So, it's really moving, I think, when you're there, because it does feel like that long-distant past is reaching out at you and holding your hand and saying, OK, here's our world, you know, now interpret it truthfully and properly, if you will.
Yeah, I agree. And Pierre actually goes on to tell us a little bit more about, well, from a maritime archaeological perspective, those exciting things that he found in the caves.
We almost excavated all the caves. We still have three of them to excavate, but there were 31 of them. It's a very huge place, and some of those caves are more than 30 meters long. So it's a very, very hard work to remove all the sand that's accumulated inside those caves. But when we arrive at the bottom nearby the floor of the caves, we have remains of boats, ropes, sails, and all the equipment of the ships that were used on the place. We have broken woods, pieces of sails and ropes, and I think that it will be possible to have a most precise idea of the way, of the technology of the ships at the time of the Fourth Dynasty from the study of the remains of boats that we have in those caves. But I think the study of the remains of boats will give us a lot about the ancient navigation.
Two questions. Why do you think it was abandoned when it was? And also, I imagine that one of the things that's so exciting about this is, as you say, it's not just about the structures that you're discovering under the water. It's the incredible detail of individual people's lives. So it's opening up, you know, a whole world, but it's opening up in individual existences too.
Yeah, that's great, and we had not expected to find such a material. We have, of course, papyri and inscribed objects that are giving us an idea of the people that were dwelling in this place, and even we have the, I think, one of the most ancient records that we have of an individual talking about his own work, but it was not expected on this place. At first, we were just looking for the way the arbor was working at that time, and so it was kind of a surprise to find the papyri on the place. It has changed the way that we can imagine the The building, for example, of the big pyramid of Giza, because we are seeing the other side of the monument in a way. Of course, it's quite evident to see the pyramid itself, but when you have a glance to the people that were building it, and when you begin to understand the kind of logistical organization you need to have this monument be built, it's really, really, really interesting. And we have those logs books that are telling the story of a small official's name is Merer, and he has different missions during the whole year. Of course, he has been sent to Wadi al-Jaf at the end of a series of missions. But before, he was sent to the quarry of Toura to bring limestone from Toura quarries to the area of the building of the pyramid in Giza. And he's telling us every day what he has done the very day he's reporting. So we can follow him on the Nile, and it takes 2 days to go to Giza with a stone on the boats, and he unloads the blocks and it goes back to Toura. And sometimes you can learn also that there are things that are not working the way he wants. Maybe because there is no wind to sail, and you have to track the boats and so on. So, but it's written, it's most repetitive, but you have an idea of the way they were organized, and it's a perfectly organized, logistically organized work that we have.
So that's just so that to make it clear for people. So the papyri, I think I'm right in saying that was discovered on land at the front of some of these magazines, these storerooms that you're talking about. And some of the inscribed objects, so I think there are anchors, like 100 anchors, but some of those inscriptions are on the anchors themselves under the water.
Yeah. We have inscription on anchors that are giving the name of the boats that were used at the time of Khufu. We have inscriptions on tools that were used by the workers, stone tools, metallic tools, and so on. We have inscription on the pottery that they were producing to keep the water, because they needed to have water with them all the time. They were living in the desert. Gives us the idea that they were very well organized. They're a perfect logistical organization of everything. At first, they try to select this place of Wadi al-Jaf because they realized that at this point they could have the water, and the water is a natural spring that is a little bit further in the mountain at the place where the more recent monastery of Saint Paul is today, and the spring is inside the monastery. Also, they are quite in front of the mining zone of Sinai, and it is also the perfect place for sailing, because you have an opening in the coral reef that is parallel to the coast at that place. So they knew perfectly well the place before, and they try to organize everything perfectly to have this harbor kept during the few months they were using it probably during spring and summer to get to Sinai.
Yeah, so I mean, what he's saying here is really interesting, because this place was only used for a relatively short period of time, but actually it was only used at certain seasons because of the nature of the winds. You know, you can only sail at certain times to cross this body of water to get to the Sinai. And that's essentially why a lot of things had to be stored, kept there, because obviously they need to be safe while they weren't actually occupying the site. It just makes it even more remarkable, basically.
It does. I mean, it's incredible. And it was abandoned. And I know that there was a bit of later damage, typically done, I think, by some Brits who explored and did a sort of very cack-handed kind of, semi-excavation. But it's, apart from that, it's just pristine. It's there just waiting as that, you know, the very last lot of sailors and logistical officers working for the Egyptian state decided to kind of leave the materials. It's an incredible place. And of course, we're talking about the stuff at the moment that's mainly on the land, but there's that whole underwater landscape to discover too.
I know, and I'd so love to have dived there. It would just be incredible, but regrettably I haven't yet had the opportunity.
Maybe, you know, because it's, if you can get there. Lucy, should we try and make that something that happens? Maybe we should go and do a live podcast from the site.
Oh, yeah, well, that'd be great. We could do it in March when they're out there.
Kaboom.
Sorted. Yep, they've just got their permit through, so it's all very exciting. They're going to revisit the underwater world of Wadi al-Jaf. So, yeah, they, actually, though. I think you also spoke to Pierre about the logistics of working underwater.
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, he expanded on what it's like and the challenges of working underwater there.
We are associated with a team of divers from Alexandria. The conditions of work for them is really difficult because it's very shallow water that we have at that place. They are trying to explore the bottom of the harbor itself. We have a huge jetty, L-shaped jetty, which is about 200 meters long from east to west, and again 200 meters long from north to south. So it's really a huge thing. And at the bottom of this harbour, we have anchors and pottery.
And I think I'm right in saying, aren't I, that this is the oldest known artificial sea harbour that's been discovered in the world.
Yeah, it's clear because it's inside the sea itself. I think we have old harbours, but they are most of them are established at the entrance of a river and close to the sea. And so it's the first time they try to do something. So yeah, it's really, really big. It's a huge thing also. I think it's the scale of the pyramids themselves. And it has been very well built because, after all, the landed part of this jetty is almost intact. It has been made with blocks. It's a perfect wall to the north, in the direction the wind is blowing, and so you have the currents that could break the jetty. And it has been compacted with muds to make it very strong, and it's very well preserved. So it's a nice it's a very spectacular installation that we have there.
Just before we leave, Pierre, I think Lucy and I, we should just have a quiet moment thinking about the papyri that he was talking about. So I think there are around 1,000 of these things.
Really?
I mean, it's a huge, huge, huge number. Yeah. And it's papyrus and it's written on with ink and it has survived for 4,500 years. And the level of detail, again, that we're getting about ordinary people's lives from that papyri is just spectacular. So that's a moment. I know that we're here to talk about water and underwater, but I thank God for sand that preserves things like that, you know, because that is an absolute gold mine.
Absolutely. But he does also mention boats. I have a very good friend and colleague, Dr. Ihab Fahmy, in Egypt. And although it was a remote interview, and you can tell because it was hot and sweaty and the air conditioning is going in the background, I did have a chance to talk to him about the work that they've been doing with the survey and excavation of the offshore jetty. So how are you going about the diving? Because I know, having worked along that coast, and you've reiterated this, it's very frequently extremely windy, and I also know that when you're diving in 2 metres of water and a lot of wind, that's not straightforward. So how do you overcome those challenges in terms of the diving?
With the first mission, actually, we had this problem, actually, because it's very windy there, and the wind there is very, very strong, so we lost some days, actually, without doing any diving. It's very hard, actually, to go on, even to work snorkeling, and it's very hard to work. So during the first mission, we study which the best weather actually to come to work on the site. Usually we go there by the end of March, beginning of April. So we use the best time just for diving with actually snorkeling to do some survey on the shallow depths. But when we start digging, actually we use our equipment, especially in the area which is their depth is around 2 meters, 1 meter and a half, 2 meters, something. And also one of our targets is to do a photogrammetry for the jetty. I mean, it was one of our targets. So
You'll need a drone.
Yeah, but actually, you know, drone, to use a drone here in Egypt, you must have a lot of...
Yes, I can imagine.
It's not allowed.
So where are you targeting the excavations?
First of all, we survey all the basin just to have an idea about the site, and then we choose some certain places to start make our excavation. So we start with the site of anchors, in which we try to dig around to find any evidence. We found some pieces of shared ceramics. So after that, we decide that we have the most important site that we have to dig it. It's at the corner of the between the eastern jetty and the southern one is connected. So this is the most important area which we can find something. We dig there and we found. I mean, it's sandy. It's a lot of sand there. So we move a lot of sand and then we found some pieces of wood, some small pieces of wood. So this gives us a very good impression that we have. We will find something. We continued our work on this corner until we found a piece of rope is extended under this sand, and it's in the same type of rope that they found it at inside the caves. And it's extended for long distance, and we keep it as it is. We have some photos, and we said that we are going to continue follow up this rope and next mission, inshallah.
Lucy, you've got to go there. You think what he's discovering, so rope underwater as well. I mean, you know.
I know,
it's
and
essential.
The bits of wood. I know, it's a no-brainer, but then... It's not just, I mean, the potential for the finds underwater are just really exciting. But then when you also think about the boats, the partial boats that they're storing in the caves, I mean, if you were to reassemble them, you get such an insight into what boat. I mean, this is not 300 years ago or 3,000 years ago. It's over 4,500 years ago, and we really just don't have extensive amount of evidence for boats from this period. And the other thing, sorry, I'm just very excited about this site, because the other thing, and this is the thing that really got me, is he talks about the anchors, but he doesn't mention the fact, he does hint at the inscriptions, but the inscriptions actually identify particular boats, and even more than that, particular crew or sort of sections of the crew within the boats. This is 4,500 years ago, and we're looking at, you know, that level of organisation and detail. We don't even have that now with crews of, or, you know, road boats. I mean, it's just remarkable.
Also, it's really important because, as we know, inevitably, history still tends to be the story of the great and the good. And you don't hear about the people who sailed these boats, who carved the anchors, who built the blooming pyramids, for heaven's sake. And here they are, you know, they're speaking directly to us. So it's an absolute treasure trove. And is really beginning, you know, there's been lots of debate, as you know, about whether it's kind of slaves built the pyramids. And it looks like actually these people, in a sense, they're free and they're being paid in rations, aren't they, the crews. But it's pretty tough. You know, there's a lot of time checking, and if they complain about their conditions, we hear from some of the papyri, you know, that is not viewed well at all. So it's an incredible insight into that ancient Egyptian world.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that you spoke to Pierre about, which is one of the most fascinating and sort of, you know, this element of mystery this site introduces is quite remarkable, but the fact that it was essentially only used for one dynasty. It's like just over 100 years or so. So all of that effort, as you mentioned, all of the resources that were thrown into this huge jetty covering, you know, 70,000 square kilometres or something. And then it's just left. It's just abandoned. You know, they stopped using it. It had served its purpose. The pyramids built, I presume. And that's it. Resource over.
It's really weird. I don't understand it. It's really weird. Because as you say, they did build the pyramid. It's the only one of the seven wonders of the world that's still standing, you know, pretty much intact. So in terms of kind of project management, it was the most incredible success, this whole thing. But the Red Sea and that particular area with access to Sinai, to all those resources we were talking about, copper and turquoise, and that hasn't moved. So why aren't they using what they built? Unless there is some superstitious religious thing that, you know, that the pyramid was basically a giant resurrection machine for the pharaoh. So maybe it's almost like, well, it's served its purpose. It's done its job for, you know, for Khufu, Pharaoh Khufu's himself and for his father. And it would now almost somehow be blasphemous to keep on using it. Mm. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. But we might find out.
I mean, no, because hopefully there's going to be. I mean, that's because I was actually thinking about this, like properly thinking for a change. Because obviously we've got these amazing boat finds at the site, but they are effectively dismantled even boats that were stored for a practical purpose, you know, literally to be put back together and to sail across the Sinai. But next to Khufu's pyramid in Giza, we have more boats that were clearly dismantled for very different reasons, for symbolic reasons, for the process of moving the pharaohs into the afterlife, you know, that amazing ship that's now reassembled. So, you know, as you quite rightly say, there's that significance that we're now exploring, we're not definitively saying, but we're exploring in terms of the different symbolism, I guess, that these sites and the finds, you know, essentially give us insight into.
And the boats are vital both for sea travel and also obviously for river travel up the Nile, and I think people forget that or don't realise that how close the pyramids were to the Nile and to you know, there was a port right outside the pyramid, which is how all this stuff ends up being, yeah. You know, the stones that then get unloaded to build it. And exactly as you say, you know, in the 1950s, one whole boat was discovered, and now another whole boat has been discovered, just buried very close to the pyramid, to the Great Pyramid itself. So there's definitely something going on there. And if you look at slightly later beautiful paintings and hieroglyphs, you see the boat is often used as the symbol of the pharaoh's journey to the afterlife. And in ancient Egyptian, the hieroglyph for a boat is often used just to represent a journey. So sort of in the ancient Egyptian mind, this boats really, really, really matter. Mm. They create their civilization, but they also have this spiritual significance. So, yeah, you know, it's mysterious and rich, that site. And it is already changing our understanding of the ancient Egyptian world. And that understanding is going to be refined and evolved and further changed with every single find that comes out of the site. So,
I think, as you say, we're going to have to go there.
Yeah,
there's no question about it. I mean, whether we've been invited or not is another matter, but we're going.
definitely. Well, you know, let's go there, take our little recording equipment, and talk as we're doing it. It would be a total delight.
So, I can be snorkeling and stick my head up above the water, going, "Definitely, I found this."
definitely. We'll definitely make it happen. So there we are. That's a reason for everybody. I know you've been listening now. That's a reason for you to listen to the other podcasts that we've been making and to the future podcasts that we're going to be doing on the shores of the Red Sea. You know, how irresistible is that? So do please join us again on Dive and Dig, a podcast made by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports maritime archaeological research right across the Eastern Mediterranean. So thank you so much for being with us and listening.